In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path to omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening, and Happy New Year. May this year be a good year for all of you. Regardless of how terrible it is sure to be.
Is it still new?
Is it still new, yeah. Well, it's going to be renewed soon with the Tibetan New Year. But have faith, okay. I will be positive. The horrible will not come about. Hey, a stalwart, intrepid travelers on the path of tenets, entering now into the final tenet system of the Prasangika Madhyamaka, which they cover in, what is it, 12 pages after, you know, it's the culmination of all the systems in a book of 430 some odd pages. Okay. But since my Prasangikas don't believe in anything, it should be quite simple and quick and fast. Maybe. So here we have the Galupa Prasangika system, which has some very interesting anomalies in it. Interesting aspects to it, let's say. So I'm on page 415 of the hard copy of the text and the Prasangika Madhyamaka section of the digital version as well. As was explained above, the founder of Prasangika Madhyamaka, Chandrakirti, lived in the 7th century and composed clear words, commentary in the root verses of the middle way. At the time, Buddha Paulita had commented or had already commented on the passages in root verses on the middle way that refute production from the four extremes, such as the statement, not from self and not from others. Other. The way they phrase this clarifies, I think, something for me that I was confused about. Somebody translated his text recently, and it didn't have commentary on all the verses of the root of the middle way. And I thought maybe the translation was missing some, but maybe he didn't comment on all of them. I have to look into that. Okay, so he says, not from self and not from other. In his commentary on the root verses, the Lamp of Wisdom, Bhaviveka, sets forth many faults with Buddha Paulita's argument. Chandrakirti then said that these faults did not apply to Buddha Paulita, that Buddha Paulita did not assert the use of autonomous syllogisms, and he proved that it is not suitable for a Madhyamaka to accept autonomous syllogisms, setting forth many points that undermine accepting them. Okay, the plot thickens. He thus found that the Prasangika Madhyamaka school is independent work, entering the middle way, in other words, not a commentary on any specific text, and its auto-commentary, which would be cool if somebody translated that, extensively delineate a selflessness of persons and phenomena that is unshared with Svatantrikas and with Svatantrika and other schools. Furthermore, as was explained above, this master composed commentaries on other works of Nagarjuna, such as 60 stanzas on reasoning, 70 stanzas on emptiness, and 80 slices of pizza, no, as well as a commentary to Aryadeva's 400 verses. Shantideva was a follower of Chandrakirti and a great upholder of the tradition. He lived in the 8th century, and his most famous works are Entering the Bodhisattva Way and the Compendium of Training, both in translation. In his own works, he upheld the Madhyamaka tradition of Chandrakirti well, in addition, which is an odd statement. Why do they say in his own works? It's weird. In addition, such scholars as Aryashura, Nagasena, the later Prajnakaramati, Maitripa, and Atisha must be counted as masters who accept the Prasangika view. Maitripa being the father of what you might call essence Mahamudra in the Kagyu tradition. Marpa goes to India primarily to study with Naropa. Naropa sends him to different other teachers to study various things and sends him to Maitripa to study Mahamudra. And so Maitripa is in the lineage from Saraha of the Mahamudra lineage, whereas Naropa actually is not listed as a holder of that lineage. Anyway, it's a sort of a foreshadowing, the fact that the Mahamudra tradition, Kagyu tradition, begins, and many of its main proponents were what are called Rongtongpas, Prasangikas of a certain type. Prasangika school is defined as the philosophical school that propounds that there is no entity-ness and that does not assert that things are established by way of their own intrinsic character, even conventionally. It is called, which is the distinction that they're making between Prasanga, one of the distinctions between Prasanga and Svatantrika, saying that in Svatantrika, phenomena are established by way of their own character conventionally, which is their opinion. It is called Prasanga Madhyamaka because without accepting autonomous syllogisms, it accepts reasonings that are known to others to create the view for the opponent, and it primarily states consequences to demonstrate internal contradictions to the proponents of true existence. Clear words says this statement mentions the similar example that is known to others and is concordant with the probandum and the proof, which presumably is a basically what the author said by saying, because without accepting autonomous syllogisms, it accepts reasonings that are known to others to create the view for the opponent. So this is the whole crux of at least this issue of autonomous syllogisms, is that Svatantrika say, well, you have to have an autonomous syllogism so that you can start from the same place as the opponent. And the Prasangikas are saying, you don't have to do that. You can take their view without creating, without agreeing upon an autonomous syllogism.
What's a probandum?
That which is to be proved is the probandum of a logical statement, and the proof is how it is proved. So, let's see. The statement mentions the similar example that is known to others and is concordant with the probandum and the proof. So, the similar example is what the Svatantrikas are turning into an autonomous syllogism, saying such as the pot exists, or the color blue exists conventionally. And as an example of a phenomena that's, let's say, impermanent, and therefore without essence. Let's say the propandum is color blue does not have intrinsic existence because it's impermanent, is the proof. And the example in that syllogism is taken as a given that it is an existent phenomena conventionally. And the Prasangikas are saying you don't need to accept that syllogism. And the same text says, thus the master, meaning Nagarjuna, for the most part dispelled the position of the other through using consequences only. So instead, one would say, Well, you say that so-called color blue is impermanent, etc., etc. The unique feature of this system is that no person or phenomena is intrinsically established in any way, yet all categories of actions and agents are possible. The ultimate root of the many unique ways of describing the world in this system is that it does not accept that persons or phenomena are established by way of their own intrinsic character, even conventionally. Entering the middle way says, know that that which has the meaning of emptiness is the definitive meaning. Let's see, what do we say? Okay, so they've been repeating this thing, does not exist even conventionally, phenomena. And they quote the middle way saying, that which has the meaning of emptiness is definitive in terms of provisional and definitive. Regarding provisional and definitive sutra, this passage is saying that they are differentiated by whether they explicitly set forth the profound emptiness of persons and phenomena. As opposed, they're saying this as opposed to those who cleave to the third turning. And those who cleave to the third turning, their logic is that in the sutras of that tradition, there's a clear delineation of phenomena that are empty and how they're empty, and phenomena that are not empty. Although they don't really say the latter, but explicitly, but basically their criteria for definitive and provisional is the degree of clarity in the statement, as opposed to the subject matter. And so the Prasangikas say that the subject matter determines whether it's provisional or definitive. When the subject is egolessness and emptiness, then it's definitive. Period. Therefore, this system asserts that sutras in the first wheel teach that all conditioned phenomena are impermanent, or sutras are provisional, and within that wheel, sutras that teach that all phenomena lack true existence are sutras of definitive meaning. Because the sutras of the middle wheel of no characteristics prove with countless types of reasonings that phenomena are not established from their own side, they are sutras of definitive meaning, because the sutra explanation of the intention of the final wheel teaches the three natures, dependent, consummate, and imaginary, differentiating them into what it is and is not, truly established in a way that accords with the assertions of Jitamatra. It is asserted to be a sutra of provisional meaning. Oof, what an insult. Don't take it personally, it's not personal. The three natures that are explained, the explanation, the attention, are key elements of Chittamatra's system. However, there is a unique way of positing the three natures in the Madhyamaka system, according to what appears in the Questions of Maitreya chapter in the Perfection of Wisdom in 20,000 Verses, where this scheme of the three natures seems to appear, which is really cool. It is set forth in the Autotalk commentary on Entering the Middle Way by Chandrakirti. A snake is an imaginary dependent rising in relation to a coiled rope because it does not exist there. In relation to a real snake, it is established as real because it is not imaginary. That sounds a little bit to me like conventionally established. But no, not. They don't agree with that. Anyway, in the same way, intrinsic nature is imaginary in relation to conditioned, dependent phenomena. If phenomena are conditioned and dependent, then they cannot possibly have an intrinsic nature. Because an intrinsic nature means independent, unconditioned, unchanging, unproduced, etc., blah, blah, blah. Thus, Nagarjuna's root verse in the middle way states, intrinsic nature is not fabricated and does not depend on another. Entityness is not something created. That which is imputed to apprehended dependent arisings. Reflection-like creations are real in the sphere of a Buddha because they are not imaginary. which is imputed to apprehended dependent horizons, reflection-like creations, are real in the sphere of a Buddha because they are not imaginary. Because the Buddha, she, understands reality through directly perceiving the true nature alone without touching created things. One is called a Buddha. That's an interesting statement, that Buddhas look at dependent arisings, that which is imputed to apprehended dependent arisings, are real in the sphere of a Buddha because they're not imaginary. That's an odd statement, isn't it? Okay, thus, it gets weirder, by the way. Thus, having understood the three natures in that way, one should explain the intention of the sutra. Where's the consummate? Did they talk about the consummate? In that way, one should explain the intention of the sutra. Regarding apprehended and apprehender, nothing exists apart from the dependent. Therefore, consider how those two are imagined in the dependent. I have said enough. I'm not going to say anymore. This is saying that these conventional phenomena, as they appear, are the dependent. The fact that it's superimposed on the mode of being onto the dependent is the imaginary, as the mode of being onto the dependent. The lack of those dependent conventional phenomena being intrinsically established is the consummate. They assert that the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, SSSEP, is the coarse selflessness of persons. The lack of an intrinsically established person, IEP, is the subtle selflessness of persons, and the lack of true existence on the basis of designation, such as the aggregates, is the subtle selflessness of phenomena. Catch that? There's a coarse and a subtle selflessness of persons, but there's only a subtle selflessness of phenomena. They don't have a coarse selflessness of phenomena in this system, it seems. The difference between these two subtle types of selflessness is not from the perspective of the object of negation. It is from the perspective of the basis that is empty. Between the two subtle types of selflessness of persons and phenomena is not from the perspective of the object of negation. The object of negation in both cases is the same intrinsic existence. It's from the basis, the perspective of the basis that is empty. In one case, the basis is a person. In the other case, the basis is dharmas. Entering says, in order to liberate wandering beings, the selflessness is said to be two types, divided into phenomena and persons. This is saying that the refutation of true establishment, the object of negation in terms of the basis of the person, is posited as the subtle selflessness of persons, and the refutation of that in terms of the base of aggregates and so forth is posited as the subtle selflessness of phenomena, because the aggregates are phenomena, right? And the person is not an aggregate, and it's not a phenomena. Well, it might be a dissociated, non-associated phenomena. They assert that there is no difference in subtlety between the selflessness of persons and phenomena, and that both of those are the final mode of being. And that is the root of another larger issue with the Galupa presentation of Prasangika, that they say that Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas have the same wisdom as bodhisattvas. They don't make the distinction that we do of 1.5 fold emptiness, egolessness. That's sort of this way of distinguishing between Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and bodhisattvas. They don't agree with that. In the Prasangika Madhyamaka system, there's nothing that is established by way of its own character in any way, and yet both a cause and its effect and an action and its agent can be posited without the least confusion. Indeed, not only are the two not contradictory, they assist each other, they work together. From that perspective, this system has many features that are unshared with Swatantrika and the other Buddhist schools. If one carefully analyzes Chandrakirti's clear words and his entry in the middle way and its auto-commentary, one can understand these features in greater detail. I like the way they say, one analyzes it carefully, as if to say, well, obviously you guys didn't analyze it carefully. Here are some of the most important among these positions not shared with other schools of tenets. Drum roll, please. Their way of positing dependent arising and the conventional through explaining the meaning of emptiness to be dependent arising. Two, their unique position that one must accept external objects while also accepting the existence of consciousness. Three, their unique way of refuting a foundation consciousness that is a different entity than the six collections of consciousness. Four, their unique way of explaining that even though there is no foundation consciousness, the connection of actions and their effects is tenable from the point of positing, maybe the point of view of positing, the disintegrated state as an impermanent thing. This is the best one. It's my favorite one. Six, their unique way of refuting reflexive awareness. And seven, their unique way of refuting that the view of reality is to be produced in the opponent through autonomous syllogisms. From among those, a few will be explained here. The others in volume four.
Which one was your favorite, four or five?
Let's see, five. Did I skip five? The unique way of positing it three times based on their view of the disintegrated state. I missed that one. Thank you, Cynthia. I think four is the winner, but the two of them are priceless. Three times is pretty good. Definitely quite good as well. The first of these is their unique position that the existence of external objects must be accepted. In general, both Vaibhashika and Sautrantika assert that when the base of composition of a coarse form is searched for and analyzed, dimensionless subtle particles are found. They apply the terms external form and external object to the forms that are established by those partless particles acting as the basis of composition. Both Chittamatra and Yogacara, Swatantrika, Madhyamaka refute external objects with many reasonings. Although Prasangika Madhyamaka accepts the existence of external objects in general, it does not assert that external objects are established through the accumulation of partless particles like the Vaibhashikas do. The proponents of true existence for whatever phenomena is posited are not satisfied with its being a merely conventional designation. They search for the designated object and simply posit it as real. Due to this, Prasangika's asserts that although neither external objects nor consciousness that are established by way of their own character exist, according to unanalyzed conventions, such as the Republican Convention, external objects as well as consciousness do exist. Conventions such as mountains and forests, when posited as they are known to the world, are not undermined by any valid means of knowledge. Also, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, it is said that both objects and consciousness equally lack intrinsic nature. And the Abhidharma said that they both equally exist, therefore they assert that it is not correct to make a distinction of existence and non-existence between objects and consciousness in terms of either the conventional or the ultimate. Is that clear as mud? Let's see. Let's do that again. Judas Prasanga asserts that although neither external objects nor consciousness that are established by way of their own character exist, good, according to unanalyzed conventions. So the cow herder External objects, as well as consciousness, exist. Conventions such as mountains and forests, when posited as known in the world, are not undermined by any valid means of knowledge. In their view, valid inferences and direct valid perception of the two types, inference and direct, do not undermine what doesn't exist. Ultimately, they only undermine intrinsic existence. They don't undermine conventional appearance. Also, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, it said that both objects and consciousness equally lack intrinsic nature, and Abhidharma said that they both equally exist. So they're equal. So, you know, one of the things they're doing is trying to distinguish themselves from Chittamatras. Therefore, they assert that it's not correct to make a distinction of existence and non-existence between objects and consciousness in terms of either the conventional or the ultimate. The auto commentary says when the non-existence.
That one is also a distinction from the Svatantrikas, right?
True. At least the Yogacara Svatantrikas. The auto commentary says when the non-existence of form is understood by reasoning, one must understand that the mind also does not exist because the existence of both is untenable. Also, when one understands that the mind exists, one must understand that form also exists because both are known to the world. It's a little bit of a mind bend, isn't it? When he says that the mind exists.
Well, is the point that they're making not so much asserting that that these things exist or don't exist, but that the distinctions and logics of making a difference between whether mind and form, you know, that it's either they're sort of saying either they both exist or they both don't exist, that some of these distinctions that other groups are making are not tenable. Is that what the point of this is?
I think very much the point of this particular statement or two sentences is that you gotta have the same way of evaluating mind and form. You can't have a different criteria for the two. They're both
right. And yet they're not really necessarily in saying that, they're not putting themselves on either side of that existence, right?
Not yet. Regarding the aggregates, form and so on, Abhidharma says that all five are similar from their perspective of their division into, say, specific characteristics and general characteristics. In the Perfection of Wisdom, all five are similar in being refuted because it says Sambuddhi form is emptiness, empty of intrinsic nature, etc., etc., up to consciousness. So, examples of how the two, mind and form, are treated the same. The existence of external objects is based on the fact that they are not established by way of their own characteristics, because establishment by way of its own character is refuted. The existence of such things as forms, which are different entities from the consciousness that apprehends them, as is known in the conventions of the world, is established. Because they are established, the existence of external objects is established. Turning to the unique way that this system posits dependent arising in the conventional, although not even a particle of a phenomena is established by way of its own character. In this system, they can accept that all agents and actions, such as karmic effects, are tenable without needing to simply relegate it to the perspective of the other person. Furthermore, simply inducing ascertainment of the dependent arising of phenomena causes one's ascertainment of their lack of intrinsic nature to grow. In this way, emptiness and dependent arising come to the aid of each other. By reason of something being empty, that it is dependently established is unambiguous. If something is empty, it is dependently established. Because something is dependently established, it is not established by means of its own entity. Therefore, being empty establishes that something is a mere appearance, and being a mere appearance establishes that it is empty of its own entity. This means that appearance and emptiness are not contradictory, because Prasangika accepts that phenomena are not independently or intrinsically established. It is most tenable for them to present ultimate truths, and because they accept that the way that they are validly established is simply that they are established in dependence on each other, it is most tenable for them to present conventional truths. Again, look at volume 4. Furthermore, in this system, it is asserted that although a long time passes after karmic actions have ceased before their effects arise, I think they should say in some cases, or many cases, whatever, but it is possible to posit the relationship of actions and effects without such things as an alaya vijnana, or inexhaustibility, avipranasha, and acquisition prapti, even conventionally. So, foundation consciousness, chitta mantra, inexhaustibility. I can't remember which of the other two are vaibhashika and which are sautrantika, but that's the idea. I think it goes in the order of chitta mantra, swatantra, sautrantika, and vaibhashika, but I'm not sure. One might ask, in what way the tenability of the connection between actions and effects is unique in this system? In general, although virtuous or non-virtuous action and effects are separated by a long period of time, I guess relative speaking, at least always, the effects, such as happiness and suffering, arise without being exhausted. Now, it's unclear whether they mean that happiness and suffering are exhausted or whether the reader is exhausted by what they're saying, or whether the karmic activity is exhausted. All the higher and lower Buddhist schools of tenets assert this. Nagarjuna says, if it remains until the time of fruition, that action would be permanent. If it stops, then having stopped, how could it produce an effect? Someone raises this objection. If the action remained, you know, so Nagarjuna's statement seems to be refuting karmic cause and effect, the infallibility. Someone raises this objection. If the action remained up to the moment before the fruition of the effect, it would be permanent, because it existed for more than one moment. Because something that is impermanent cannot produce an effect. Now that's an interesting given assumption in the system, that if something is permanent, it can't do anything. It can't function. So it can't produce an effect, which is a type of function. Because something that's permanent cannot produce effect, it is not tenable for there to be the connection of an effect arising from an action. Because either if you accept that the cause is impermanent, then it stopped before the effect arose, so they never met. Or if you assert that the cause continues up until the time of the effect, then you're saying that it's permanent, and something permanent can't result in an effect. And if that action is destroyed in the second moment of activity, no action would exist up to the moment of the fruition of the effect, given that it is not tenable that the disintegrated state of an action is a functioning thing. How does an effect arise from an action? It's so funny that they say this. Given that it is not tenable that the disintegrated state of an action is a functioning thing. So if phenomena arise and disappear instantaneously, so the disappearing side of the equation is called disintegrating. And can the disintegrated state of a phenomena that arose and disintegrated instantaneously, can it be a functioning thing? And it, since they say, given that it is not tenable, how does an effect ever arise from an action? So they give a little review. Chittamatra following scripture, which is Sautrantika Chittamatra, would dispel this objection by saying that there's no fault, because at the time of the disintegration of the action, the predisposition of the action and the foundation consciousness, the basis of infusing that keeps predispositions inexhaustible, exists. Ah, so inexhaustible maybe also referred to, appears to also refer to Chittamatra. It's possible that all three of those terms they used a little bit ago, where they said it's possible to posit the relationship of actions and effects without such things as foundation consciousness, inexhaustibility, and acquisition. Okay, so back to where we were. Let's see, there's no fault because at the time of the disintegration of the action, the predisposition of the action, foundation consciousness, the basis of infusing that keeps predispositions inexhaustible, exists. The way the objection would be dispelled by Vaibhashika has already been explained. Sautrantika would dispel the objection from their perspective of accepting that although the action has already disintegrated the continuum of consciousness, which is the referent of the idea of a person, that is the place of infusing, the predispositions of those actions continues to exist. This is the Sautrantika. They're saying that the Sautrantika accept that a person is a real phenomena. It's a non-associated phenomena, but if it's a specifically characterized phenomena, then it can function in the way that they just described. Let's try that again. Sautrantika would dispel the objection from their perspective of, okay, accepting that although the action has already disintegrated the continuum of consciousness, which there's, as the Prasangas are saying, each of the schools, when they talk about the person, they have a referent, like where does the person live? Like in Vaibhashika, I think they would say the person lives in the collection of the skandhas or something like that. And here the Prasangas are saying that the Sautrantika say that the referent of the word person exists or resides rather in the continuum of consciousness, which is similar to the Chittamatra would say it resides in the continuum of the foundation consciousness.
So how, I was going to ask, how is that?
Ooh,
consciousness,
froze.
It sounds like it's awfully
you froze.
Similar,
right? You said, how is that? And then you froze.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, odd. Okay.
So if you could just repeat that.
I was just saying, how is that different? They may not use the words Alaya Vishnana, but it sounds awfully similar.
It does. So let's see how the Prasangikas respond, what their version is. They're giving you the Sautrantika version, their version of the Sautrantika version here. But okay, regarding the Prasangika position, Chandrakirti, in his famous text, says, because it does not intrinsically cease, because a phenomena does not intrinsically arise or abide, it can't intrinsically cease. Therefore, it has the capacity, although there's no foundation consciousness. Okay? You're all in agreement on that? In sum, although the action ceased long ago, one should know that the effect arises properly. Now, in sum was not S-U-M, but S-O-M-E. Little puzzle. Puzzling response there. I like that. They assert that it is not feasible for something that arises in dependence on cause and conditions to have an intrinsically established cessation. So cessation is not intrinsically established. It's only conventionally conventionally existent or whatever. Therefore, although such things as the foundation consciousness do not exist, it is suitable for the disintegrated state of an action to be a functioning thing. Now, didn't they say a little earlier that the disintegrated state of an action could not be a functioning thing? Did I get that right? Up at the top of the page. Given that it is not tenable that the disintegrated state of an action is a functioning thing. And now they're saying, it is suitable for the discriminated state of an action to be a functioning thing. Therefore, although such things as the foundation consciousness do not exist, it is suitable for the disintegrated state of an action to be a functioning thing. Okay. Even though the action...
It seems like the problem isn't so much what they're saying. Well, it's that they're just saying this, but without a how.
Yeah. Well, let's see if they fill in the how. And even though the action in the continuum of consciousness of some person ceased long ago, the effect of happiness or suffering arises from the continuum of the ceased action. That's getting really good. Ceased actions.
So there's a continuum of ceased actions floating around in the world?
It pretty much fills the space. That's
unconnected
right.
to any entities.
Yep.
Cool.
You can see why people like Meepom had a field day with this stuff. If actions and their effects were intrinsically established, they would not depend on other causes and conditions. If an action ceased intrinsically, then after the cessation of the action, it would have no capacity whatsoever. There are such problems. Not quite sure what that means. In brief, because actions are not intrinsically established, meaning not ultimately established, the disintegrated state of an action can be posited as being established based on its cause, i.e. conventionally. Therefore, the disintegrated state connects the action and effect. Presto, change-o. There you have it. That is merely designated in dependence on the aggregates is posited as the basis of infusing predispositions that is continuous, and the consciousness is posited as the basis of infusing that is occasional. So the basis of infusing predispositions. So they're acknowledging that there's predispositions and that they infuse something. And they're saying that there's two types, continuous and occasional infusions. And the basis that is infused in a continuous manner is the I that is merely designated in dependence on the aggregates. So the I that is designated in dependence on the aggregates is a generality. It's a non-functional thing. It's an idea. And it's the basis of infusion.
So it's a non-functional thing, but it can hold predispositions.
Yeah.
It seems to me that all it seems like they're doing is not naming, I think it's clear that the Alaya Vijnana is a construct of mind also, and it's just a way of sort of describing an aspect, It seems like they're not really saying something radically different. They're just
using different terminology.
That one of them is putting a name on it just because it's easier to put that kind of name on things to have a handle to talk about them. But the basic principle or mechanism of, infused predispositions is so much the same. It doesn't matter whether you call it a separate consciousness or not.
It's a little bit the same. This whole thing about the disintegrated state being functioning thing is really bizarre. We'll hear more of that in a minute.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so let's see, where the hell were we? Oh, at the very bottom. Thus, a foundation consciousness is not needed as the basis for the infusing of predispositions of actions having searched for the designated object among the aggregates. Even the person does not need to be found. Therefore, they do not assert that the foundation consciousness is the referent of the person. They do not assert a foundation consciousness because it is not possible for something to be established by way of its own intrinsic character. Even though they're establishing all sorts of things without having intrinsic character. For this reason, they posit the mere I that is imputed by thought as the basis for the infusing of predispositions. So the illusion of a self is the basis for karma, for where karma resides. There's no point in accepting the foundation consciousness. In this system, the disintegrated state is asserted to be a functioning thing. In the other schools, when the designated object of any phenomena is searched for, I don't understand what they mean by that, the designated object of any phenomena, it is asserted that it must be found. I think they mean like the referent of a term or something, but for example, when a sprout disintegrates, everything that is part of the sprout ceases. It does not obtain the status of something else, such as a pot. So a sprout that ends its sproutness does not turn into potness. Okay, yeah, I accept that. The parts or the collection of the parts of such things as pots are not an instance of any disintegrated state. What are they talking about? Therefore, for these other schools, what is called the disintegrated state is asserted to be a non-implicative negation. It's not a real thing. The factor of the mere cessation of another thing, it is not asserted to be a functioning thing. This has already been discussed, first volume, in the context of the chapter 8 on the three times. In Prasanga, however, it is asserted that when a designated object is searched for, no phenomena is found. For example, there is nothing to be posited as the referent of the person, not the five aggregates of the person individually, of the person, their collection, or anything that is a different entity from those two. It's a little odd that they said the five aggregates of the person. However, it is not contradictory for that which is posited as the person, in dependence on its aggregates, to be a functioning thing. Oh my God. They're so bizarre. They're totally on drugs.
Well, is it because in the first statement, I mean, the statement which one of them said individually, the five aggregates individually? Oh, no, then it said the collection also. I'm sorry. That's mind-boggling. Are they actually not?
In the same way, regarding the disintegrated state, neither the thing that is disintegrating nor something of the same type is suitable to be posited as its instance. However, because it is produced in dependence on the thing that is disintegrating, it is asserted to be a functioning thing. If I was an artist, I would like do a whole series of paintings on the disintegrated state.
Interesting idea.
The functioning of a disintegrated phenomenon. How would you display that? How would you show that the disintegrated state is a functioning thing is set forth in scriptures. It's supported by the Buddha himself in the 10-level sutra, the Dasabhumika Sutra. He says, death in two activities, sorry, is two activities coming together. It destroys, that is what it is composed, and it acts as a cause of continuing ignorance. So, if we revisit our nidanas, our pratitya samuppada, death, I believe, is the 12th and last of the nidanas. And the idea is that the 12th gives rise to the perpetuation or fuels the perpetuation of the first, the cycle, right? So that's why he's saying it acts as a cause of ignorance. So they're saying that they're taking this quote where the Buddha says that death is a cause of something. Now, you might quibble over the translation of that phrase, but that's the way they're understanding it. The same text says the statement through the condition of birth, there is aging and death, which is the formula of the Nidanas, means that the condition of birth is the continuation and support of aging and death. The condition of birth is the continuation and support of the continuation. This is
That's
saying
the
that.
same thing of saying it's the cycle of nirvanas. It's saying it in two different ways. One is saying it from the point of view of death leads to birth, and the other is saying birth leads to death. So it's kind of saying the same thing as the other line, I think.
The word condition is throwing me. Is it like causes and conditions? Anyway, this is saying that death is produced by causes and produces its own effect. So they're taking death to be a conventionally existent phenomena. It's produced by causes and produces its own effect. So something produced by causes is a thing, and something that produces an effect is a thing. So, like, they're saying that death is a phenomena, is a thing. Death exists as a phenomena. Now, I don't remember death being on any list of non-associated formations, but it was not meant to be exhaustive. So,
What
death is
category do you think it would fall in that in the normal schema?
not on the map. I
Just
think
off the map entirely?
death is a misnomer. There
And
isn't.
life also?
Life is a generally characterized phenomena, as is death in my
Well, right,
book.
so I mean, wouldn't they have to be sort of in the same general category?
The two of them, yes, I agree. I accept. Which is the debate term.
Yes,
Death.
thank you.
Death is the disintegrated state of a being that was born. So, sentient beings' disintegrated state has both its own causes and its own effects. Therefore, I don't know, it's just so funny, it's hard to read. So, like, a dead person can continue to do things.
This is really weird. Just that statement, death is the disintegrated state of a being that was born. That's a really weird statement because,
It is. It's
I mean,
also bizarre.
death is obviously I mean, you could look at it as a change of stage, in the cycle, but to say it is the disintegrated state is sort of making it as if it, again, as you said, is like a thing.
Therefore, a sentient being's disintegrated state is established as a functioning thing, which is the category of conventionally existent phenomenons. That the disintegrated state is a functioning thing is also established by reasoning. Chandrakirti's commentary on 60 stanzas of reasoning on reasoning says it would then be logical for the lamp to become no more without the exhaustion of the oil and the wick. This, however, is not the case. Therefore, there is no intrinsically real cessation. Sounds to me like he's saying the opposite of what the Prasangikas are saying, but let's see how they work their way out of this one. This is saying that the exhaustion of the butter and the wick is said to be the cause of the extinguishment of the butter lamp's flame. Therefore, the disintegrated state of a continuum of fire is proven to be a functioning thing. Based on this, one can understand that a functioning thing in the first moment, although it disintegrates in the second moment, a disintegrated thing disintegrates, is a functioning thing. Can you believe how bizarre this is? And Prasangikas are the pinnacle. The
Can we
pinnacle.
go? Yes, the pinnacle. Yes, said in the definitions, could we review what is a functioning thing? What is the definition of that?
That which produces an effect, such as the next moment of its own continuum, or to be observed, to be observable.
So you can observe the butter lamp with no flame. I mean, but so the
Kevin,
I'm just trying to figure out what they really mean by this disintegrated state as a functioning thing. I think in the butter lamp case, I can imagine
it's it's a mythical entity that produced, that is a carrier of the karma.
You know,
karma continuum. Kevin.
Back when they quoted,
was that Nagarjuna?
The 10 level sutra says, right? Mm-hmm. Death is two activities coming together. It destroys that which is composed, and it acts as a cause of continuing ignorance. Okay, so they're saying acts as a cause is an effect. But,
well, the ignorance is the effect, and that death is a its cause, and therefore it's a functional thing.
No, they're saying death acts as a cause, if we are to take this translation as accurate. So act as a cause, I don't understand how they equate that literally with an effect.
It's bizarre.
and that's, I think, the root of the whole problem.
You know, it's a third turning sutra, which they said was provisional.
Yeah, for good reason.
And so it clearly seems to be a provisional statement, where the Buddha did not mean that that death acts as a cause, as
right.
a thing.
They just take that interpretation and run with it ad nauseum for their...
Yeah, yeah. You read the whole thing, I take it. So yes, it goes on ad nauseum. Okay, so this is saying that the exhaustion of the butter and the wick is said to be the cause of the extinguishment of the butter's lamp's flame. Therefore, the disintegrated state of a continuum of fire is proven to be a functioning thing. Based on this, one can understand that functioning thing. Next paragraph. Furthermore, if disintegration has a cause, then the disintegrated state must also have a cause. Otherwise, there would be the fault of an absurd consequence that production would have a cause and the state of having been produced would not have a cause, which also is absurd. If one differentiates the disintegrated state and disintegration based on whether they have a cause, then one would also have to differentiate production having been produced, because otherwise it would be undermined by the reasoning of equality. So nobody says that production itself has a cause. They say that things are produced by causes, not production. Production is a generally characterized phenomena that refers to the activity of specifically characterized phenomena being produced by causes and conditions. God, these dingbats.
Funny, for all that they are thought to be the ones that reduce things to non-entityness, it seems they like they're making things out of everything, out of concepts, you know?
Yeah, it is so weird.
Very bizarre.
This system asserts that the disintegrated state is disintegration. Therefore, it is able to posit that things not remaining for a second moment is the disintegrated state. If a thing that does not remain for a second moment is a functioning thing, then a thing that has not remained for a second moment must also be a functioning thing, because both are similar in that they are produced by causes. This system does not posit something like the disintegrated state of a sprout to be a functioning thing by having searched for the object designated. It posits the disintegrated state as a functioning thing that is produced in dependence on another functioning thing that is disintegrating conventionally. Isn't that like a sprout? Root versus says things and non-things are conditioned. Oh, wow. This is saying that a thing like a butter lamp and the non-thing of the butter lamp, that is, its disintegrated state, are both conditioned. That's precisely because they're the ones that say there's different types of conditioning. There's conditioning based on three types of conditioning or dependence. There's dependence on causes, there's dependence on parts, and there's dependent on conceptual designation. So that's what when Nagarjuna says non-things are conditioned, they're conditioned by conceptual designation. Okay, therefore both disintegrated states and non-disintegrated states are similar in being functioning things. Causal relationship of invariability that is intrinsically real is lacking even for a non-disintegrated state. As for a causal relationship of invariability that is posited merely on the conventional level, this is present in a disintegrated state as well. In brief, the disintegrated state, being a functioning thing, rests also on the fact that nothing is intrinsically established. By refuting that it is intrinsically established, it is established as a functioning thing that is merely nominally and imputedly existent without existing from its own side. You know, this sort of is summed up by the notion that they don't have an idea of true and false, kunzop, or relative truth. You know, all relative phenomena are dependently designated and merely nominally and imputedly existent, but some of them function and some of them don't. Anyway, by establishing that, then the disintegrated state of a sprout, without being a non-implicative negation, that is the mere opposite of the entity of the sprout that existed earlier, love that, is proven to be a functioning thing that is merely posited, having been designated with a name, taking that very non-implicative negation to be the basis of designation. A non-implicative negation is now the basis of designation. Next, they're going to say a non-implicative negation is a functioning thing. Right? That's basically what they're saying. Based on this, whatever cause and conditions that have become the cause of the designation of a sprout establishes it as a thing that was produced. Based on this explanation that the disintegrated state is a functioning thing, this prasangic system has a unique way of presenting the three times. The path, for instance, consists of the transformation of a cause that becomes an entity that retains its continuity. Whatever the hell that means. It is not simply the cessation of a present moment. That factor that is not produced for the time being, because the cause to produce a different thing exists, but the conditions are not complete, is posited as the future. That which has produced and has not ceased without being either of those, past and future, is posited as the present. Therefore, unlike the other systems, they assert that all three times are functioning things produced by causes and conditions. If I had come out of this on my own, you would all be like totally laughing, like, come on, that's not prasanga, that's bullshit, that's total bullshit. That's the commentary in 60 Sentences on Reasoning, Chandrakirti's. You know, so the task is to see the quotes that they're using and to see if there's another way of interpreting the quotes. Because they're interpreting the quotes, obviously, as supporting their bizarre thesis that a disintegrated phenomena is, the disintegrated state of a phenomena is a functioning thing. So for each of the quotes, the task is to see if there's a different way of interpreting that quote than the way they're doing. So from Chandrakirti's commentary in Nagarjuna's text, because it is possible for the non-existent to be a cause, it is not reasonable to say the non-existent is not suitable as a cause. So when he says the non-existent, what is he referring to? could be referring to all conventionally existent phenomena, with the term intrinsically existent being omitted but understood, implied, right? You might say that when it is analyzed with reasoning, it is impossible for it to be a cause, but that is not the case, because the things of the world are not to be analyzed and then accepted. It is just the way the world is. So he now replaces the non-existent with the term things of the world are not to be analyzed. So that's the famous way of understanding the prasangika from the Kagyu point of view, is that the conventional is not to be analyzed. It's just accepted on face value as sort of phantom-like phenomena, appearance, mirror appearance. In the world, it is said that the non-existent is a cause. People say, because there was no water, the grain was ruined. So the absence of water is the cause of the ruining of the grain. Is there another way to say that? Why did the grain become ruined? So become ruined presumably means there's mold growing on it?
Or a plant dies if it doesn't have water. It shrivels up and dies.
Right. So what's the cause of that? Is it the lack of water? Is the lack of water the cause of the shriveling up?
Well, you could, you know, I think the fact is that there's multiple causes and conditions, and it might not be just water. It might be too much sun. It might be, you know, all sorts of things like that. But
what if all the other conditions are perfect and there's no water?
It would die. Things die. I mean, if you
obviously,
don't want
obviously,
plants, they die.
But how would, obviously, but what's the chain of causation there? What caused, you know,
well, you could
is
say,
the death of the plant a thing?
Well, I don't understand. They're saying death is a thing. I don't understand them saying that the past, present, and future are things. None of that makes
sense. So the
sense
alternative
to me.
Is to say that a plant is the state of a plant growing and living is produced by the causes and conditions of water, moisture, heat, and so forth. And when those causes and conditions are absent, then the life force disappears.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or, you know, that made life force into a thing. How about it doesn't grow any further, it doesn't become larger.
I think what you would say is that the plant changes in nature. I mean, you know, there's a nice, lively-looking plant, okay?
Which is a conventional existent anyway. The plant is not a specifically characterized phenomena, right?
But if I think of a specific green bean plant that I grew last year on my rooftop, you know.
You killed it? You forgot
to water
it? Most
of them are dead now, but, you know, it's the cold comes along and that kills them too.
Sure, it was you.
No, I kept them alive as long as I could. Anyway, so...
Because there was no food, my child died. It wasn't my fault. I didn't forget to feed them, my child. My child died because they didn't have food.
Well, you think of places where there's famine, which there are many now.
In that way, because there was no water and no food, I know there's zillions of examples of there not being enough food for children to live. But I'm talking about the way they're working with the logic here. In that way, because there was no water and no food, the grain was ruined and the child perished. So what is Chandrakirti saying in that statement? Because the things of the world are not to be analyzed and then accepted. It is just the way the world is. For example, in the world they say that the non-existent is a cause. He's giving another he's giving an absurd example of something that's not to be analyzed and accepted. He's not saying that lack of water was a cause. What do you guys think?
Well, when you're saying, okay, because it is possible for the non-existent to be a cause. So a non-existent is what we conventionally think of as a thing, right?
Yes. Well, He's now saying that, he's now clarifying that the non-existent is things like no water. So he was not talking about things in the way I was thinking.
Okay.
So I would scratch that. But this is not the case, because the things, when he says things of the world, yes, he's meaning everything, both like water and grain, as well as the absence of water. He's talking about things and non-things, really, what we would call things and non-things. He's summing up into the term things, right? And then he's giving examples of absurd things that the world accepts as something that we should not analyze and we should not accept, because it's absurd to say that the absence of water is a cause.
You're saying that's absurd? Why is that?
Saying that drought is a cause or famine is a cause. And we do accept those in our conventional world as intellectual constructs of something, even though, in fact, they are negations. But we don't call them, I guess we do call them things, don't we? I mean, you talk to a climatologist or an agronomist, they'll call drought a thing.
Well, in a way, if you look at it a different way, I mean, we call it drought, and that makes it a sort of a conceptual thing, but you could just think of it as dryness, you know. The condition that occurs in the absence of water is dryness. And so
the absurd extension of this is that nirvana is a thing and is produced by the extinction of kleshas and ignorance. And that is universally denied, that nirvana is not produced. And the Buddha says that over and over again in the early sutras of the first turning, when people ask him about nirvana. I said, nirvana is not something that's produced. It's like, and he uses this example over and over again, it's just like when a fire has gone out, you wouldn't say, where did the fire go? Did it go to the north, the south, the east, or the west? There's no fire because the productive elements required for fire have ceased. No fire is not a thing. It wasn't produced by the running out of productive causes of fire. Does not produce no fire. No fire is not a thing.
Well, isn't it really just a matter of how we conceptualize things? Isn't that what we're talking about?
It is, but the way these people are interpreting it is they're ascribing reality to
things. Reality, yes. They're describing something that is not quite physical, but non-physically real.
Okay, so let's go on. The future is also a functioning thing. Same text says, the lack of the condition of the future serves as a cause of something not being produced. If it is not the case that the condition is lacking, it will definitely be produced. So another quote from the same text by Chandrakirti, perhaps out of context, perhaps construed in a certain way, when the wick of a butter lamp is exhausted. Now, the wick of a butter lamp is this, like the string, right? So if the wick is burned to the bottom, there's no more flame. The fact that the conditions for producing a similar type of butter lamp later are incomplete is the cause for a similar type of butter lamp not being produced in the future. Therefore, if such causes are not incomplete, the future is produced. Based on those reasons, the future is also asserted to be a functioning thing. It is most tenable that although nothing exists intrinsically, things exist from the perspective of depending on others and being designations without being utterly non-existent. Therefore, one must distinguish between existence and intrinsic existence and non-existence and intrinsic I have a hard time saying it. Intrinsic non-existence. Intrinsic meaning truly established. That is, between the two types of existence and two types of non-existence, the clear words says, we do not say actions, agents, and effects do not exist. What do we posit? We say, those do exist, do not exist intrinsically. And the auto-commentary is this understanding the description of cause and effects of reflection that does not intrinsically exist, since such things as forms and feelings that are not different from cause and effects are observed to be something that merely exists, what wise person would determine that they have intrinsic existence? Therefore, although they are observed to exist, they are not intrinsically produced. In general,
isn't that a ridiculous pair of two words to put next to each other?
Intrinsically produced.
That makes
contradictory.
No sense at all.
Yeah, it's contradictory. In general,
yeah, it's a non sequitur.
It is.
Really?
For something to conventionally exist, three factors must be completed. It's known to be to a conventional consciousness. How it is known is not undermined by other conventional valid means of knowledge, and it is not undermined by reasoning that analyzes reality. All the other schools assert that the extreme of non-existence is dispelled by appearance. So they're actually sort of undermining their own argument, but they're saying, okay, if a school says that non-existence is dispelled by appearance, then they're making non-existence into a functioning thing. Right, so appearance, non-existence does not need to be dispelled. Conceptually, it can be correctly understood by the fact of appearance, but in the extreme of existence is dispelled by emptiness. However, there are many unique assertions of the Prasangika. For them, the way that the extreme of existence is dispelled is by impermanence, appearance. Whenever something dependently arisen appears, the lack of intrinsic existence vividly appears. The lack of intrinsic existence is a thing.
Well, in that saying, aren't they saying that by, I just got to the wrong page. Aren't they just saying that because things arise, then it's,
they're saying not finding.
It's not intrinsic because.
Not finding can be found.
Okay, I guess I was. Yeah, sorry. I lost my page there. Okay, wait. So. I thought they were just saying that. By virtue of something appearing. Then it's because it's dependent, it wasn't already there, and therefore it's not permanent, solid, and all those things that you said are the definition of intrinsic.
Yeah,
right?
Except for the, except, yeah, except for the second part, where they say the lack of intrinsic existence vividly appears.
No, I think that goes along with it, that because something appears, oh, never mind. I don't know.
The way that the extreme of non-existence is dispelled is by emptiness. Whatever appears, that very appearance of the absence of intrinsic existence of phenomena causes it to vividly appear as a mere imputation of thought. In commentary on the thought of Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti described the Madhyamaka system as distinctly superior to other systems. What a surprise! That he would describe his own system as superior. That's very unusual. The auto commentary says, this is a system in which the doctrine of emptiness expressed through responses to objections does not appear in other treatises. We ask scholars to be certain of that. Therefore, one should know that whoever says, whatever the Sautrantika say is ultimate in their system, whatever the Sautrantika say is ultimate in their system, Madhyamaka asserts to be conventional, is only saying that they have misunderstood the reality of the meaning of the root verses. Those who think that whatever Vaibhashika says, ultimate Madhyamaka asserts to be conventional, have only misunderstood the reality of the meaning of that treatise. This is because it is not correct that supermundane phenomena are similar to mundane phenomena. This system is unique. Scholars be certain of this. For that reason, those who do not understand the thought of the master, who are frightened by ascertaining just his words without having ascertained the reality of their meaning, completely abandon supermundane phenomena. Therefore, in order to set forth without error the reality of the meaning of Nagarjuna's treatise, I have composed this entrance to the root verses in the middle way. This is understood from what he clearly states, together with the reasons this system's presentation of the two truths and how they delineate reality. We explained in Volume 4, this Madhyamaka tradition delineated by Nagarjuna represents the tradition of the profound middle way, where emptiness, the mode of being in which phenomena lack even a particle that is intrinsically established, is explained to be the reality of dependent arising and was elucidated by Chandrakirti in a way that it differentiates it from the other Madhyamaka schools as well as the proponents of true existence. It is hailed by all Tibetan Madhyamakas, the apex of all the Indian Buddhist schools of thought. The tradition of holding the system remains alive to the present day. This concludes the presentation of Madhyamaka based on treating the Prasangika system as foremost. The conclusion: having provided just a rough explanation of the philosophies of the non-Buddhist and Buddhist schools of ancient India in general, the four Buddhist schools of tenets in particular, it's now time to conclude, to summarize regarding the term tenets in general, based on the perceptions of the natural awareness of a particular person at the conclusion of investigating and analyzing the method to achieve happiness and dispel suffering in this lifetime or the next. That person's tenets would be posited as the viewpoint from which they decide whether philosophical truth is correct or incorrect. All four schools of Buddhist tenets are similar in being free from the two extremes of permanence and annihilation from the perspective of their respective systems, and in asserting that they present the truth in accordance with objects' mode of being. However, because they have different presentations on the basis, different ways of asserting their views, it is obvious that they identify what it means to fall to the extremes of permanence and annihilation differently. In general, if one considers what is shared among the Buddhist schools of tenets, the conception of the person as partless, permanent partless, and independent, is the view of permanence. Because they do not accept that, they are free from the view of permanence, and not accept that happiness and suffering are effects that arise without confusion or without fail from virtuous and sinful actions, is the view of annihilation. Because all Buddhist schools accept that actions and their effects cannot be confused, they assert that they are free from the extreme of annihilation. Roughly speaking, each tenet system abandons the two extremes according to their unique views as follows. Vaibhashika say that because they assert that when an effect is produced, its cause ceases, they abandon the extreme of permanence. And because they accept that an effect arises immediately after its cause, they abandon the extreme of annihilation. Sautrantika say that because they assert that conditioned phenomena operate continuously, they abandon the extreme of annihilation. Because they nonetheless accept that those conditioned phenomena disintegrate each moment, they are free from the extreme of permanence. Chittamatra say that because they assert that the imaginary is not truly established, they abandon the extreme of permanence. Because they accept that the dependent and the consummate are truly established, they abandon the extreme of annihilation. Madhyamaka says that because they assert that all phenomena conventionally exist, they are free from the extreme of annihilation. And because they prove that they do not exist ultimately, they are free from the extreme of permanence. Turning to their unshared assertions, the proponents of the non-Buddhist and Buddhist schools of India compose extensive, etc., analyses and refutations using many types of reasoning. Each takes their own systems. Tenets as valid and true is determined with correct reasoning. When one analyzes the assertions that other schools of tenets have proven with reasoning, not only are many of them shared with the tenets of one own school, but as has been stated by many scholars of the past, a great many of the assertions, arguments of other schools become like the steps of a ladder, leading gradually to the profound philosophy of one's own school. In general, the non-Buddhist Buddhist tradition's philosophical tenets were founded by wise masters in accordance with the intellect of a great many disciples. When one considers this, one can understand the statement in Shanti Deva's Bodhicharyavatara, which he says that lower positions are undermined and outshone by higher views. Skipping the quote, the stanza saying that what is accepted by ordinary worldly people, such as those whose minds have not been affected by tenets, and those who assert that partless subtle particles, partless moments of consciousness, and mere things are true, is undermined by the intelligence of worldly yogins who realize that all phenomena lack intrinsic existence, even among yogins who have attained the union of Shamatha Vipassana, the realization that all phenomena lack intrinsic existence due to a difference in superiority of various yogins' intelligence. The higher outshines the lower. For example, the permanent things that are accepted by non-Buddhists are undermined by the reasoning in lower Buddhist schools of tenets that proves that permanent things do not exist. The partless subtle particles that are accepted by the two Shravaka schools are undermined by the reasoning of the Chittamatra and other schools that refutes the existence of partless particles, subtle particles. The truly established consciousness that is accepted by Chittamatra is undermined by the reasoning of Madhyamaka that refutes true establishment. So this is a good way of reviewing the views of the four schools on these various topics. In this way, one understands that the unshared positions of the former are refuted by the reasoning of the latter. To summarize, Tirthikas, for example, emphasize and prove the existence of a permanent, partless, independent self. This is refuted by Buddhist sutras and treatises in general, and by the various reasons of all earlier and later schools, scholars of the higher and lower Buddhist schools of tenets. A series of Tirthika scholars of logic and epistemology propounded that the Vedas are valid, held that the view that expressions and thoughts operate by way of what is established in the object itself rather than through exclusion, and they compose many refutations and assertions in support of that. The Buddhist logician Dharma Dignaga delineated an extensive presentation of the exclusion of what is other and refuted this Tirthika view. A succession of Buddhist scholars, such as Dharmakirti and his heirs and Shantarakshita, greatly clarified the system that propounds the exclusion of what is other through debate, responding to debate and rebuttal. To illustrate this, among the Buddhist schools of tenets, Vaibhashikas assert that the disintegration of a conditioned phenomena depends on a cause that is a different entity that arises later. So they view that disintegration is a separate entity that interacts with all phenomena in their second moment of existence and causes them to disintegrate. Sautrantak and so forth refute this with reasoning, arguing that conditioned phenomena have a nature. They're programmed obsolescence to disintegrate from their own cause. Also, some Vaibhashika accept the existence of an inexpressible self. The Pudgalavadins, many Madhyamaka Chittamaja scholars such as Vasubandhu and Chandrakirti set forth extensive reasonings that undermine this assertion. Also, proponents of true existence assert that external objects that are composites of partless particles are truly established. Such scholars as Vasubandhu set forth many types of reasonings that refute partlessness and express the faults of that position. The Vaibhashika asserts that sun's consciousnesses comprehend their object nakedly without an aspect. Such scholars as Shantarakshita set forth many reasonings that undermine this. The Chittamatra scholars do not assert external objects and prove with various reasonings that the dependent and consummate natures are truly established. And in addition to that, Chittamatra following scripture asserts the existence of the foundation consciousness and the afflicted mental consciousness. Such scholars as Bhava Viveka, Aviveka, and Chandrakirti set forth extensive reasonings undermining that. Moreover, the proponents of true existence assert that dependently arisen phenomena are truly established. Nagarjuna refuted that with limitless arguments in his collection of Madhyamaka reasoning, and the great Madhyamaka masters who followed him expanded on those refutations within Madhyamaka. Such figures as the Swatantrika scholar Bhaviveka accepted reasons that are established from their own side. The works of the Prasanga scholar Chandrakirti refute this extensively. Many subtle and detailed arguments illustrated this way between the non-Buddhists and the Buddhists, and even among the Buddhists, such as Vaibhashika and Shautrantika, many unshared assertions of the former are undermined by the correct arguments of the latter. This is implied in Nagarjuna's text, the five stages, the Panchakrama, the sort of root text in the Galupa tradition for Vajrayana, the whole completion stage practices in what's called the Arya lineage, which stems from Arya Nagarjuna and Arya Deva, which says the perfect Buddha described this method as being the steps, like the steps of a ladder. Kamalashila's second stages of meditation says all the words of the Bhagavan are well spoken directly or indirectly. They illuminate reality directly, or they flow to reality. If one understands reality, then just the coming of light clears away darkness. One becomes free from all of the sets of views in accordance with the explicit intention of such teachings, just as in the world one proceeds up a ladder by means of ascending from the lower to the higher rungs. In the same way, the many positions delineated with reasonings by the lower schools of attendance become the means of understanding the view of the higher schools. Hope you don't mind a few extra minutes here as we finish this. For example, the assertions that Tirthagas are superior to those of an ordinary person does not analyze at all whether it itself exists. Furthermore, many of their methods of analysis and their presentations of logical reasoning serve as the foundation for the spread of Buddhist logic. Many of their descriptions of mental states, such as ways to achieve one-pointed samadhi by means of pacifying the manifest affliction of attachment to the qualities of the desire realm, are shared with the proponents of the Buddhist tenets. The permanent self propounded by the Tirthakas, and refuting that the impermanent person propounded by Vaibhashika, are a means for Sautrantika to understand that the person is imputedly existent and not substantially existent, in the sense of being a freestanding thing that can be apprehended as a substance apart from the aggregates. Understanding the Sautrantic assertion about the person and the relation between the object of expression and the expression is imputedly existent and not a functioning thing is a means for Chittamatra to know how to present actions and agents without any phenomena being established on the basis of their names through their own mode of subsistence. Understanding that Chittamatra posits phenomena in that way is a means for Svatantrika Madhyamaka to understand how to posit phenomena without their having a mode of subsistence that is not posited by the power of their appearing to the mind. Understanding that Svatantrika Madhyamaka posits phenomena in that way is a means for Prasangika Madhyamaka to understand how to posit all phenomena not being established as their own mode of subsistence. That section was pretty good. That's a nice review of the different views. Thus, between these non-Buddhist and Buddhist schools of attendance, the latter school is more profound than the former, of course. However, through a careful analysis based on the philosophy of the lower, the higher only becomes more profound. This way in which Buddhist schools of attendance are like the steps of a ladder from the form of the ladder can be established, illustrated rather, with an example. All the proponents of Buddhist attendance accept that conditioned phenomena are like illusions. However, the latter school is more profound than the former in the way that they use the example of a magician's illusion. Vaibhashika used the example of the impermanence of continuity, of course, impermanence, in the sense that just the illusory horse or elephant exists at the time of the magician's illusion, but becomes non-existent when the illusion dissolves, so the body and possessions of this life must come to an end or death. Sautrantika used the illusion as an example of a subtle impermanence, and that because the magician's illusions change from moment to moment, they have the quality of disintegrating upon being produced without depending on another cause that arises later. Chittamatra uses the example to show that just the horse or elephant does not exist from the side of the pebble or stick that is the base of conjuring, but is merely the factor that appears to a consciousness affected by the matcha and substance. So such things as forms and sounds are merely factors that appear to an internal consciousness without being established as external objects. Madhyamaka used the illusion as an example of the fact that apart from being merely apart from merely being posited by the power of appearing to the mind, phenomena are not truly established. However, there is a difference between the different Madhyamaka sub-schools, because Svatantrika asserts that phenomena are established from the side of their basis of designation. In the context of the example, the illusory horse or elephant must appear from the side of the basis of conjuring. They assert that if they did not appear in that way, there would be the fault of that even in a place where there was no basis of conjuring, an illusion would appear due only to the eyes being affected by the mantra and substance. Prasangika uses the example to show that just the illusion conjured by the magician is not a horse or elephant, yet appears to be so. To be so for phenomena such as the person, when one searches for some nature that is established from the object's own side, there is nothing to be found despite it appearing to be established. from its own side. The appearance of the illusory horse or elephant is not due to that appearance being established from its own side, but is due to whether the mind imputes it to a horse or an elephant. For example, due to the thought apprehending the horns of a rabbit, the horns of a rabbit are apprehended, but something else that does not exist, such as the son of a barren woman, is not apprehended. In the same way, they assert that whether the object exists or not, it is imputed by the mind. Therefore, furthermore, they assert that if the horse or elephant appeared from the side of the pebble or stick, they would be the fault of the appearance of the horse or elephant would have to be produced even for a member of the audience whose eyes were not affected by the mantra or substance. As this illustration shows, there are many topics in the philosophies of non-Buddhists and Buddhists that contain major differences, with the views of the latter schools emerging as more profound when compared to the views of the former, turning to the view of no self. As it is said in the sutras and the eloquent explanations in the Garjana and Sangha, compared to the latter levels of selflessness, the former are easy to understand and serve as a means of entering into the latter. These levels of selflessness are, one, the lack of a self that's permanent, partless, and independent. The selfless, two, the selflessness that is the lack of being self-sufficient and substantially existent. Three, the reality, which by the way means findable among the aggregates. Three, the reality that is the lack of external objects that are a different entity from internal consciousness. Four, the lack of an ultimately existent entity, although all phenomena exist by way of their own character. That's Vachantrika. And all phenomena lack even a particle that is established by way of its own character, even conventionally, yet it is possible to present all categories such as cause and effect, obviously prasanga. For some people, having been taught to view the lower schools of tenets, if they are led gradually higher, such progression becomes meaningful. Otherwise, if they are taught the highest view from the start, far from it being beneficial, it could cause great harm. Therefore, one will gain the certainty of conviction that these various traditions of tenets that were created by the Grand Masters with discernment and with the intention to benefit others are solely a source of benefit and happiness for disciples of a variety of capacities and interests. Thus, gathered here and organized in a special way are descriptions of reality, as well as many important philosophical topics found in the classical Buddhist sources, the scriptures of the conqueror Shakyamuni, and in particular the treatises of the great Buddhist philosophers of ancient India that were translated into Tibet. And this completes the first of two philosophy volumes presenting the non-Buddhist and Buddhist schools of tenets, the third volume overall in the fourth volume series, Science and Philosophy in Indian Buddhist Classics. So, at least we finished that. We didn't make it to the path text. So, next time we meet, we go through the paths, start to go through the way that the paths are presented in the formal way, like this. Paths and stages, or stages and paths. And next week is WMC's retreat that I'll be attending along with Barbara and unfortunately no one else of those among here, us here. We will miss you and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. Shall we dedicate the merit or does anyone have comments, questions, suggestions, anything else?
I do have a question, although it doesn't have to be answered now, but in the when we were going through that very fast run through of everything, and I guess it was on, well, I can't tell you what page because you have different pages. I'm wondering, since I wasn't fully satisfied with the reasonings in this, the part where they say such scholars as Bhava Viveka and Chandrakirti set forth extensive reasonings undermining, for example, the existence of the foundation consciousness, what would be the best sources for trying to read and understand what their actual arguments are? Because I felt like what they said here were more like statements of course that doesn't exist, but it didn't really give the arguments of why not.
Yeah, so Chandrakirti's Introduction to the Middle Way, of which there are numerous translations. There's one by Padmakara. And in the sixth chapter, he which is the sixth bhumi. He goes, it's a line to organize among the bhumis. He goes through the refutation of production from the four possibilities of self, other, both, and neither. And in the refutation of production by other, he goes through the earlier Buddhist schools, which he considers to be production, believers in production from other. And so in there, there's a whole discussion of the Alaya Vijnana.
Okay, I figured that was probably it. I have to go back and review that since it's been a long time.
For Bhavaviveka, I'm not sure. There is a translation that came out recently of his, I believe it's The Blaze of Reasoning.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. That's really a commentary in Nagarjuna's text, and Nagarjuna does not go into refuting the Alaya Vijnana. So there must be some other place. I don't know if it would be in there or not. But, yeah.
Okay. I just wondered if there were, because I just.
The best one is Chandrakirti.
Yeah, okay. I just didn't feel like satisfied that they really laid out the whole.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're struggling to find it, email me and I'll help you find the section.
Sure. No, that's. I'm sure I can find it. I kind of knew that would be probably the answer. So thank you.
And interestingly, there's a book by Tsongkhapa that I can't remember the title. Where he goes through the Chittamatra system and so you, in detail, so you can see his version of that. And I can send you the title if you're interested. But, okay, shall we dedicate?
Yes.
By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. I was thinking as I was saying, you know, by this merit may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, which is the cause of anyway.
It's
thank you.
We could also remember Emily, and that, you know, have good wishes for her.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure by the time we meet again she will have two young creatures. Have produced. Is she producing them? How were they produced? Oh my God.
We can ask her what she thinks about that after.
Yeah, she would have the closest perspective of that, right?
Are they a cause or an effect?
Oh goodness. Both, right?
Both. Right.
I mean, you can't be a mother without a child, right? So
that's right. Very definitely a cause and an effect. Unless you believe in other
sexual or neither, because
things like virgin birth and stuff like that.
Thank you. Nice to see you all. Take care.